get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early! Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon. And the purpose of this podcast, as you know, is to focus on finding solutions to the problems we face, not just endlessly fixating on the problems. That said, some problems are about process. They are about how they can become worse or better. And our guest this week is Patrick Radden Keefe. He is really one of the great authors and investigative journalist of our time, writing at The New Yorker now. One of his most famous books is called Say Nothing, which is about the Troubles. But we're going to talk to him about that and much more. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you.
You too, man. You too. And it turns out we went to the same high school a million years ago. But I was an admirer of his work before I found that out. First of all, a couple of caveats. There is no perfect parallel, even as much as I loved applied history, to, you know, the Troubles certainly, and to what America is facing today. That is, of course, the euphemistic name given to the violent divisions, particularly in Belfast, Northern Ireland, in the later decades of the 20th century. Nor are we going to talk about the Good Friday peace process, which was ultimately successful. A fascinating, important topic, but not your area of expertise. Instead, what I want to talk about with you is that process that you wrote about so eloquently of the escalation and radicalization that led a country even to deeper violence, and what echoes you hear today or are concerned if we don't contain could get worse.
Absolutely. I certainly am hearing those echoes all the time.
In what specifically? I mean, Charlie Kirk obviously was a moment where we didn't see the executive tamp down the calls for vengeance, which is what typically happens in American history.
For me, I'd almost go, so it's interesting, right? I started working on this project more than 10 years ago. I read an obituary in the New York Times in 2013, and in 2014, I started work on a New Yorker article initially that came out in 2015. And then the book came out in 2019. And while I was working on the book, which is about the Troubles, you know, this protracted conflict in Northern Ireland that starts really in the late 60s and it ends, as you mentioned, with the Good Friday Agreement in the late 90s, it felt to me like I was writing a period piece. I was writing about something very, very remote from my experience as an American in, 2015, 2016. The imagery, the idea of, you know, mass popular protest, radicalization of people, a real kind of ideological pitch battle, militarized police out on the streets, all of that felt just like something I kind of couldn't conceive of happening in my own country. And then there was this sort of strange thing, which is that we ended up turning it into after the book came out, we turned it into a television series, which took another 5 years. And during that process, suddenly this story that had seemed very remote to me in a way felt much more germane, that a lot of the kind of images that I had in my mind's eye and in the research I was looking at when I was working on the book suddenly bore some resemblance to the things that I was seeing on the streets of the US. And here what I'm talking about is things like, I mean, during the Black Lives Matter protests, right? The idea of like large numbers of people out on the streets, and then also kind of up armored law enforcement out there as well, and the kind of clash that happens between state authorities and people who, you know, for the most part, are peacefully protesting.
And also sort of militia groups and self-styled vigilantes on the perimeter, particularly I'm thinking of Kenosha, things like that.
Yeah. And the kind of tendency that the most extreme voices have to radicalize and kind of inflame any situation, which was obviously a much different situation in the late 60s, early 70s. But the thing that's really extraordinary and to me the cautionary tale of the Troubles is that, you know, the mid-1960s in Northern Ireland, you have these two communities, you know, the Protestant community and the Catholic community, that had really deep cultural and political divisions, but had been living in a kind of, you know, a cold state of harmony for a long time without crazy violence. And then basically between 69 and 72, it all pops off. And in 72, people are killing each other on the streets.
What's the initial catalyst, the initial spark that within only a few years leads to mass street violence?
So without getting into too much detail, it is important to understand some of the particulars of Northern Ireland and what kind of gave rise to the Troubles. And all of this, I should say, is just, you know, as you said, it's much, much different to the U.S. There's not really an easy parallel. But basically, the island of Ireland had been ruled by Great Britain. You end up having the Irish War for Independence. And in the early 1920s, you get partition of the island. Basically, what happens is when we talk about Ireland today, generally you're referring to the Republic of Ireland, which is the 26 counties in the southern part of the island, which is the Republic of Ireland. It's its own independent country, right? Part of the EU. But then when that partition happened, there were six counties that remained part of the UK. And you had this kind of strange thing where in the Republic of Ireland, it was majority Catholic. In Northern Ireland, it was majority Protestant, and they got there with some gerrymandering in terms of how they drew the lines. Yeah. And Catholics in Northern Ireland, this Catholic minority, had very few kind of economic and political rights. So they weren't able to find good jobs. They weren't really participating in the democracy in the same way that Protestants were, in part because it was your rights were tied to property ownership. And so you've essentially in the 60s got the birth of a civil rights movement, a peaceful civil rights movement looking for more civil rights for Catholics. And interestingly, it was modeled very explicitly on the U.S. civil rights movement. So you had people who were studying the Selma March and saying we should be doing that same kind of thing here. And what happened was that when you started getting initially this peaceful civil rights movement, it met with really fierce resistance, both from Protestant, kind of what they would call loyalist groups who wanted to remain part of the UK, who in some cases were violently cracking down on these peaceful protesters, but then also from the police, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, who were very Protestant, heavily Protestant. And ultimately, you get the British Army comes in to kind of intervene, and you have the Irish Republican Army. So you get the development of these armed groups. In the case of the IRA, it had existed before, but it had been sort of dormant, and it comes back to life in a really serious way. And so there's this sort of mutual escalation that happens where, you know, you send in the army and in theory, it's like, okay, they're going to come in and be the ref, but it's not perceived that way. And it ends up really only inflaming the situation.
The escalation that occurs, obviously violence, this is the calculated, attempt by political violence to inflame, right? That it, certainly we saw this in the American Civil War at the initial skirmishes, that the people who want political violence, and everyone's got their reasons, right? That's the most terrible thing about it, is that they are calculating escalation, right? That they want to provoke revenge. And at what point does that hit a point of no return for a time? Where the escalation is off to the races.
I mean, I think it's complicated. I think in some instances you had different types of violence, right? So you have some of it was just pure sectarian violence, right? It's people going out and knocking heads with people who are from the other tribe. I mean, the irony, it's, you know, it's the kind of Freud's idea of the narcissism of minor differences, right? If you or I were to go to Northern Ireland and talk to people, it's very hard to differentiate between somebody who's culturally Catholic or culturally Protestant. You know, certainly from an American perspective, like most of these people look pretty similar. But in fact, if you're there, there are all these very fine-grained distinctions. So there's sectarian violence, which is just doesn't even have really a larger political ambition. There was political violence of a sort where certainly on the Irish Republican side, there were some people who felt we are never going to negotiate our way to a united Ireland, which is what we want. The only way for our rights to be protected will be in a free and united Ireland in which the British are out. And the only way for us to get there is through essentially going to war with the British state, which is what they did. Then you have this kind of interesting thing with the British state itself, which is that they send in the army, again, ostensibly on a peacekeeping mission. I mean, it's interesting when the British army initially arrives, this is now we're in the early 70s, famously, they're greeted by, you know, the housewives of Belfast with cups of tea, because there's a sense of, oh, you know, finally, we've had all this civil unrest. Finally, here's the army to kind of sort everybody out and bring peace. But very quickly, the perception became that the British army actually was sort of an auxiliary of the loyalists, the people who were loyal to the British state and of the Protestants, and that they weren't being fair in how they were policing this situation. And so then you start getting these clashes with the army really significantly. And this is something we've seen in the U.S. just in recent weeks. The army starts using tear gas. And there's this kind of fascinating moment in the early 70s where if you take a very fractious group of people who may not actually have all that much in common, they may not agree on a lot of the more fine-grained political questions, and you tear gas them all, it has the perverse effect of pulling them together in really virulent opposition of you, the person who's tear gassing them. I mean, it's an incredibly counterproductive tool.
Yes.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam, a charming man who infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
That's kind of where I wanted to go. I mean, you know, there is the threat of escalating violence, of threats of violence, the way that makes people dig in. There's the fact that in America, we have a normally the president tries to be a unifying figure. This president does not. That obviously exacerbates polarization. But also we've got, you know, weapons of war in the streets of America now. We have masked officers. And part of the conversation, the debate, the discussion around the most effective means of protest, I'm on the, you know, peaceful protest is essential, because there are those who believe that Trump and those folks want to provoke, looking for an excuse to invoke the Insurrection Act, which has been floated frequently. What are the lessons that can be taken, the road not taken around the escalation that we can learn from here?
I agree with you. I think peaceful protest and protest that is peaceful is essential. It's interesting when you look at the No Kings rally across the country. I mean, there's a whole lot going on there that's fascinating. It's interesting to me the way in which it's covered and not covered by the press.
Tell me more about that.
Listen, as a member of the press, it sometimes makes me roll my eyes that there are some people I think sit around and kind of deconstruct New York Times headlines all day. I think that that, you know, generally speaking, the press, you know, people who are actually out there trying to get it right, even if they don't get it right all the time, they're not the enemy here. I do think, though, that when you get millions of people on the streets in the U.S., to me, that's a kind of above the fold A1 story. It should be the first thing that everybody's talking about. I I think it's a little bizarre. I mean, on the one hand, I sort of share the frustration that I think there are a lot of keyboard jockeys out there who, you know, their activism is retweeting someone and kind of sitting on their butt, feeling whatever they're feeling, but they're not likely to get out there on the streets. The interesting thing is then people get out there on the streets, and to some extent, the velocity of the news cycle is such that, you know, it's a story for a few hours over the weekend, and then we're not talking about it anymore. But to me, keeping those peaceful, the fact that you had so few arrests, for instance, out of that mass mobilization of people, right? And overwhelmingly, those were peaceful demonstrations. I mean, all you have to do is city by city. You know, in most instances, you're looking at these huge numbers of people who are out on the streets and nobody's getting arrested. So that to me is a promising indicator. The thing that I keep thinking about with specific reference to the Troubles is that a kind of undue escalation of force by the state. And in this case, you know, you're talking about the National Guard, you're talking about ICE, I think tends to have deeply counterproductive results, even for the regime that is sending those folks out there, thinking that what they're going to do is restore order. I think that those kinds of heavy-handed tactics, I think, are going to have a wide range of unintended consequences, not least of which is just that, you know, you watch the footage of people being dragged from their cars, of these kind of crazy, crazy episodes of these ICE guys descending on neighborhoods and chasing after, you know, and any random guy or woman who isn't, you know, visibly white. And I think there's a kind of demoralizing factor for the citizenry at large. I don't want to be alarmist here. The Troubles is very different, and I don't think that that's the future that we are looking at. But I do think that if there's a sense that you kind of come in with shock and awe on your own people, and that that's going to be the quick solution to a better status quo, I think that's just deeply misguided.
Yes, it's the opposite. And I think the only dark undercurrent is if there are those radicalized voices inside the administration who believe that escalation will help them achieve their ends, which is something I shouldn't have to say, right? I mean, it's a deeply un-American idea.
Yeah, but you also have to ask, like, what are those ends, right? I mean, it really is a question of what you... I ask myself, what's the end game that these... Like, what does Stephen Miller have in mind? And tactically, he's you know, these guys are much more efficient than the first Trump administration was. Strategically, I don't know. I mean, I really think you have to ask yourself, what's the, you know, tell me how this ends, right?
You know, I wrote a book called Wingnuts 15 years ago that was really about my reporting around the initial right-wing protests around Obama's election. Mm-hmm. So all this stuff is kind of in embryo. But for a certain brand of militia-adjacent Christian nationalist rhetoric spouting, the demographic and cultural changes in America were such that they felt force was a reasonable, perhaps the only way to push back, to restore, to take America back. That's always been the threat. Sometimes it's actually escalated into real violence. But now, when met with pure executive power, you know, there's the sense that this is where, you know, senators like Mike Lee, who are parsing whether America is a democracy in the 2020 election, you start seeing the outlines of something different and sinister, where, you know, we respect elections if we win. That's, I think, the background music that I'm most concerned about. And that's where cycles of violence and provocation, we need to be really wide-eyed about where that leads.
Yeah. And I think not least because, I guess 2 points. One is that one thing that was so striking in the context of Northern Ireland is that there was this, I think for a lot of people, there was this sense of it as a civilizational battle, that this was kind of existential.
Correct.
And I mean, this is another example of the sense in which I kind of had my anthropologist hat on when I was writing that book, because I didn't relate to this at all. I mean, and you know, I mean, maybe this is me as a coastal elite, right? But I think of pluralism and heterodoxy as very wrapped up in who I am as a citizen and the country that I want to live in. So the notion of a certain kind of diversity doesn't feel remotely threatening to me. To some people, it really does. And there is a sense that they have to kind of lay it all on the line. The other thing, though, that's unconnected from that and picks up on what you just said is that definitely in the context of the Troubles, there's a sense in which violence takes on a logic of its own and a kind of momentum of its own, actually disconnected from any larger political project. It becomes much more about a kind of tribal tit for tat in which, you know, their side did this, my side did that. You get a huge amount of whataboutery, right? Where you can essentially justify almost any conduct with reference to what the other side has done at some other time. Yep. And again, to me, that's an abyss that we as a country should really be doing everything we can not to tumble into, because once you're in it, it's very hard to get out.
And that's why not getting sucked into these cycles of violence is absolutely essential for us right now. I want to sort of bridge to a tributary of this, which is, and it directly relates to the work you did in recreating the world through extensive interviews. You know, one of the risks of radicalization and escalation is you get into a place where everyone has their own facts. And then there's an additional burden in our time where we get to a place where facts might not even matter to large swaths of people. I mean, there's no debate as a matter of fact about who won the 2020 election. But Trump supporters believe, absent facts, that the election was stolen. And that seems to be a uniquely dangerous place just for getting on the same page of reality.
Yeah. And listen, and for people in the business I'm in, it's pretty discouraging, right? Because I think we can acknowledge, right, that there was that the sort of halcyon days when Walter Cronkite comes on and he tells
the
100 million people or whatever it is who are watching him that evening, the news, and you take it for granted that this is, you know, this might as well be the word of God. Yes, obviously that model was flawed in all kinds of ways. It was a sort of particular type of news that you were getting. Probably that's a situation in which you would look at that and the critique, and a reasonable one, I think, would be to say that there should be a multiplicity of points of view and of narratives. The trouble for me is that, particularly with the advent of social media, we've swung so far in the other direction that now you end up with, yeah, your facts and my facts. And it's funny. I mean, I do think ultimately Trump is kind of a sui generis personality who, you know, this story doesn't really work if it's another kind of personality in his shoes. But I also think that when the full history is written a century from now, it's really the advent of social media that gives rise to all of this. And I think that absent social media, Trump doesn't do what he ended up doing. And so that to me is the concern, is that the texture of reality has changed. We're all living in these kind of algorithmically bespoke little virtual realities in which you see whatever your feed presents to you. And so even to go back to what we were talking about a minute ago, if you look at the No Kings rallies, you know, I like to think that what is fed to me on my algorithm is an accurate picture of what was happening. But I'm certain that there are many Americans, tens of millions of Americans, who saw a very different version of that day because that was served to them. I don't know the way out of this. I do know that as somebody who's in the facts business, I go out there and I talk to people. I go in with a very skeptical eye, always with everybody I talk to. I'm always stress testing everything I hear, cross-checking everything I can. The New Yorker has this big fact-checking department. So even after I spend months and months working on a piece, I'll turn that into the fact-checkers and they take a skeptical eye to everything that I write. Like their default assumption is that I've probably gotten it wrong. And they go through and they put that piece through the fire. Sometimes two, three fact-checkers working for a week or 2 weeks going through every sentence, every line. And so what comes out of that process, it's not infallible.
No, but you know, it's pretty, we still get things wrong. Boot and suspenders.
It's pretty close. Oh. And you know, I think of it as it's 0.99999 getting closer and closer to one. You may never get there, but it's in the effort. And I hope it's not a thing we've lost sight of. In a kind of weird way, I sometimes think that with the advent of all this AI junk and the kind of, if I can use this word, the sort of enshittification of everything, that the information environment that we access through our phones and our computers and our tablets is actually going to get so kind of clogged with garbage that there may be a little bit of a swing back, in the sense that there's just, there's so little kind of quality control on what's out there that I do think that most people are going to, at a certain point, I hope, that the fever will break a little bit, and you'll realize that sometimes the truth is actually, it's right outside your door. It's kind of staring you in your face. It's talking to other people. It's actually seeing what's going on in the world. It's not, you know, whatever it is that's presented to us through the little portal of our phones.
Get ready for Malice, a twisted new drama starring Jack Whitehall, David Duchovny, and Carice Van Houten. Jack Whitehall plays Adam. A charming Manny infiltrates the wealthy Tanner family with a hidden motive to destroy them. This edge-of-your-seat revenge thriller unravels a deliciously dark mystery in a world full of wealth, secrets, and betrayal. Malice will constantly keep you on your toes. Why is Adam after the Tanner family? What lengths will he go to? One thing's for sure, the past never stays buried, so keep your enemies close. Watch all episodes of Malice on November 14th, only on Prime Video.
That is my hope as well. We just need to make sure it's not breaking down by education, that we're appealing to people's common sense and probably using a little bit of nudge to get people there.
But how do you think how do we do that?
You know, I could see a mechanism on people's feeds, for example, to address free speech area concerns, where you've got a civility mode and a sewer mode. This has been proposed by a friend of mine. And, you know, people can spend all their time swimming around the sewer, but they're going to get cholera and dysentery, you know, mentally. Or, you know, you can say, you know what, I'd like to have a lot less crazy and conspiracy. And, you know, and so there's an opt-in that's easy. You know, because that's when I hear you tell the famous story of the rigorousness of the New Yorker fact checkers, which is true. You know, it doesn't stop a widely reported New Yorker piece from being denounced and dismissed as fake news and liberal media.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When in fact, there's no such, it's the opposite in terms of, you know, fake versus fact. So I do think we need to take ownership of rebuilding the guardrails. And it doesn't need to be, you know, top down, but there needs to be leadership. And we need to start, to me, putting the strengthening and survival of democracy as sort of our determined reaction or response to this divisive moment. I think anything further gets to the degradation and destruction of democracy, which plenty of, you know, our adversaries would like to see. And maybe that itself can be a rallying point. But I think we need to focus. We can't be hands off and observers about this. To me, as citizens, we need to really take the reins right now.
I agree. I'd also say, you know, as a parent of two kids myself, I think as parents, right, I think that that the you know, not to give up on this generation, but I do think that the that as we raise kids, we need to be sort of mindful of what it means to be, you know, in the same way that ideally you're telling them to eat healthy and whatever else, right? That you sort of say, watch what you consume. Here's how you can be. I'm always telling my kids, just like do a little bit of a little bit of due diligence, do a little bit of a kind of a, like, what's the provenance of any, you hear some fact on a YouTube video. Well, where did it come from? You know, can you trace that back to something that seems like a reliable source? It's the most elementary thing, and it drives them crazy when I say it. But I do feel as though it's a thing that parents should be thinking about with kids.
They should. And not every child is raised by a journalist. That's where I want to get to next. Just sort of your thought. You don't cover Trump exclusively. You've written about the Sackler family, the opioid epidemic. You know, your profiles I recommend to everyone. But how do you think about covering Trump too? And sort of the best practices you can see based on what we've learned. And I'll just share one of my own beliefs. You know, I was part of a large newsroom in which there was a great debate about whether you should cover Trump like any other candidate. This is in 2024 or in the road leading up to 24. I was very much of the opinion that January 6th meant you did not cover him like any other candidate. There were other well-intentioned people that really disagreed. I think his actions now reveal who was right in that debate. But on a more sort of tactical as well as strategic sense, how do you think about covering Trump too? What have you learned? What do you think are the best practices?
I mean, I'm still figuring it out. I will be honest with you. I wrote quite a lot about the first Trump term. And I was basically approaching the job the way you normally would. And writing big pieces and trying to expose things. I think the challenge for me as somebody who does a lot of investigative journalism is I was thinking about this when Robert Redford died. I was raised on All the President's Men.
Right.
My sense of what it is to be an investigative journalist was forged in that kind of mythology. And at heart, what that kind of mythology boils down to is that you have some wrongdoing, you have some corruption, you have some malfeasance at a high level. The conspiracy goes straight to the top, you know, and then you have an investigative journalist and they work really hard, to expose the bad thing that's happening. And then once they've exposed it, some ref steps in. Maybe it's the public, maybe it's Congress. But some referee steps in to put an end to the bad stuff and that you've exposed. And I think the thing that I really wrestle with in this moment is that those laws of physics, like the laws of physics that I grew up with, have been suspended. And so now what happens is bad thing happens. Journalists expose the bad thing. Maybe you get a few hours of kind of outrage in some predictable quarters and indifference in other quarters, if not people just condemning you for exposing it. And then nobody steps in to do anything. And by the next day, there's some new outrage, some other bad thing, some worse thing that's been going on. So I think this creates a kind of existential challenge for an investigative journalist, right? Because the efficacy of the work that you do is suddenly kind of questionable in the broader landscape in which we are. I think it's still very important to do that work. I think I'm probably with you that, and I probably would have been with you, you know, even before January 6th, that these are not normal times and Trump shouldn't be covered like a normal politician. I did write one piece during the first term about Mark Burnett, who's the guy who created The mm-hmm. Apprentice. And that whole piece was about the fact that Trump is an incredibly brilliant reality TV star. Like, he's got this kind of combustibility. He's got this charisma, this unpredictability, this grandiosity, all the things that you cast for if you're casting, you know, a season of Survivor, right? And he was so great at that. And then this kind of interesting thing happened, which is that he became a politician, sort of defying all expectations. And there's a sort of weird sense in which politics just became entertainment by other means. And as all this is happening, you get social media ramping up. And so there's this kind of nefarious thing that he's able to do where it's all entertainment at the end of the day. And that, I think, is a thing for the press to avoid. And it's hard because it's also quite separate from this. It's a weird moment in terms of the business model for cable yep. news, for newspapers, for magazines. And so I think that there are sometimes business reasons why you might want to sort of lean into it and like take the stuff that they're constantly serving up all day, every day, the sort of chum that they're throwing in the water, and do something with it. It's a gift. People click on it. They engage. But the thing that I'm finding really demoralizing is that I feel as though that whole encounter is like, it's like all calories, no protein, right? It just kind of, it's like eating junk food. And to me, the answer remains go out there, document injustice, do it without fear. In a strange way, I'm less worried, honestly, about rank and file reporters who I think have done incredibly heroic work and continue to do great work every day. I'm worried about the like centimillionaire CEOs of the companies that own a lot of these entities, who are people who've worked their whole lives to have the kind of money where in theory they could have the autonomy to do the right thing. And it's just been like one portrait of cowardice after another on the part of people who really do have the resources where it could be a moment where they, you know, where history remembers them admiringly because of what they did. And I think one person after another, one CEO after another is doing the opposite.
Constantly failing the moral test, taking the knee, putting short-term interests over long-term interests. It's really a condemnation of the state of our society that we've devalued character to such an extent. On the reporting side, look, some people, the road to hell is paved with rationalizations, right? And one of the arguments you hear among good journalists is, you know, is access is important. Therefore, you have to cover with some credulity. You've got to, you know, you have an occasional beat sweetener in the name of, you know, fake fairness is what I sometimes call it. You take a pretty dim view of the necessity of access journalism, as any good investigative reporter does. Explain how that applies to our time.
Yeah, I mean, I've always had the feeling that access was somewhat overrated. And I say that, you know, particularly when it comes to people in power. I noticed, you know, I've been writing for The New Yorker for 20 years. And I noticed that if there's a CEO or a big cultural figure, you know, a musician or an athlete or what have you, and you're desperate to get the interview, a lot of the time you're making all these trade-offs in order to get that access. It's all very stage managed, you know. You're in a conference room for 20 minutes. You've been told in advance what you can and can't ask about. There's a PR person in the room. There's a lawyer in the room. And at a certain point for me, I just kind of felt like, you know what? I don't need that stuff. And there's a series of compromises you take to get there that feel to me like a betrayal both of the truth and of the reader. And so I felt that way even before. In the context of the Trump administration, it's much more so. In the sense that these people lie, right? Like they lie shamelessly. And I just don't know what it gets you, really,
correct,
to sit down and talk to them. And I think the dangers of you becoming kind of a stenographer. So on the one hand, it's outrageous what's happened at the Pentagon, the fact that the press corps has all been pushed out. And the fact that, you know, even Fox News is walking and the Wall Street Journal, it should tell you something.
To their credit, yeah.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I don't know that, you know, sitting through a press conference with Pete Hegseth's Office of the Secretary of Defense, like, I don't know. I don't really know what that gets you, right? Pete Hegseth is like a reality TV star. He's not a real person. He's not actually, right, engaging in a way that makes any sense. So, yeah, I think it's a tricky thing to kind of wrap your mind around as a journalist, because so much of what we do, I think, is premised on this value system in which, like, did you get the interview matters a great deal. But I think in general that kind of access was overrated. And I think specifically with reference to the Trump administration, that kind of access is kind of useless. It's sort of counterproductive.
Yeah, I think the only danger of this moment is we have essentially a dark Pentagon, at least within official channels, that, you know, if a country is taking extrajudicial, normalizing extrajudicial killings, it becomes a little more difficult. But a well-resourced reporter should be able to circumvent and punch even harder in pursuit of the truth. I'm curious about one of the articles you did that did have a demonstrable effect in the first Trump administration, which was a profile of Carl Icahn that sort of got him fired in effect. What lessons did you take for why that was effective? Because so often the Trump team doubles down when someone is confronted with ugly facts, you know, a la yeah. Pete Hegseth. And whether that would have the same effect in a second Trump term.
It's so amazing. It feels like a different world. But in, I guess it was probably 2017, Carl Icahn, an old buddy of Trump's, guy who was worth $19 billion, you know, one of the original corporate raiders, had been brought into the administration with an official position, I think, unpaid. And so the idea was he could maintain his business interests, but he was supposed to be Trump's czar for deregulation. And it emerged pretty quickly that he was primarily just advising Trump to deregulate things in ways that would help Icahn's own book. And so I wrote a big piece about that. I talked to Carl, talked to a bunch of people in the administration. And as we were fact-checking the piece, as we were about to close the piece, simultaneously Icahn quit and was fired. And it was a little bit of a kind of, you can't fire me, I quit. You know, you can't quit, right. We just fired you kind of thing. And it's amazing. I mean, I don't know. It's like a moment where there was something, where the Trump administration had something resembling a kind of shame. You know, a sense that was a grift too far. And it seems so quaint compared to like the headlines every single day now. I wonder if part of it was that the person who was really benefiting there was Carl Icahn. It wasn't the Trump family. Yes. Like that may have been his original sin, was that this is, you know, it's not actually a you scratch my back, I scratch yours situation. It's like we all scratch the same back. So maybe
somehow
that
that's
was
too vivid a metaphor for me.
I suppose so. Yeah, we don't need to go there. But the but I also just think that in those early days there was a kind of responsiveness to some of the basic democratic norms that has gone out the window. I will say, you know, in fairness to them, I think the perspective of Trump and Miller and Vought and the people around them is that they have a mandate this time around. They won again. They told us what they were going to do, and they won the election. So I think their perspective is maybe those norms are, maybe Americans don't actually, their hypothesis is that maybe Americans don't actually care about all that stuff you learn in civics class in high school, all those norms that we grew up with.
I think that's the test. I mean, they did do things like say, I've never heard of Project 2025 and all that, but they even view that as just normal lying. Not a scandal. I want to close on three quick shop talk questions. First of all, I'm very struck. I mean, you recreate a scene beautifully, and you do it in a very literary, you know, narrative style, which you do by interviewing a lot of people. And I wonder, just from a stylistic perspective, how you translate, you know, decades old stories based on interviews into being in the room. And yet still passing the kind of fact check that the New Yorker might demand. I mean, just from a stylistic standpoint, I'm interested.
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, that's the whole game. It's really fun. It's incredibly labor intensive. And I like the fact that most people who pick up my books, you can read them almost like you would a novel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a story. It's about characters. You don't need to know about the troubles. You don't need to know about the opioid crisis. I want to kind of bring you in and get you turning the pages. I'm pretty shameless about that. I don't want to write books that people don't want to read, or that they put down and then don't pick up again. And so I want to engage you and tell you a story. Behind that, there's a huge amount of work that goes on, because a lot of the time I'm writing about rooms I wasn't in. I may be writing about people who are dead. I may be writing about people who are alive, but wouldn't talk to me. And so that involves interviewing everybody I can, getting documents, you know, finding recordings, emails, text messages, anything I can.
Photographs, I see.
Photographs. I was just, you know, I'm working on a story right now in New Orleans. And I won't get into too much detail about what it's about, but I was just in New Orleans. And some of what I was doing was just driving to places that I know there's a moment where I know these guys meet up in front of an office, and I just, you know, I drove out to the office just to kind of walk around and walk those streets and take some photos and be able to recreate it myself.
I love that. I did the same thing walking Lincoln's Path from the river to the Confederate Capitol.
Amazing. Yeah.
And it, obviously very different, you know, same slope, different, you know, topography.
No, sure. Yeah.
But yeah, I really do appreciate that. The other question I love asking is, what authors or books do you find yourself returning to refuel for inspiration?
Gosh, I mean, one of the weird things about writing for the New Yorker is actually when, you know, back when you and I were in high school in Massachusetts, I started reading the New Yorker. And so one of the great treats about being there is that there are these people who for me were like I'm from Boston. So I'll say they were, you know, they were like, it was like the Red Sox, right? It was like these, you know, there were these people who were these kind of, these huge figures in my mind's eye who I've gotten to know as colleagues and friends. And so there are people like, I mean, you name it. I revisit the work of Janet Malcolm, who I knew before she died. Larissa McFarquhar, who's a colleague now. There are profiles that Larissa wrote back in the late 90s, early aughts that I still take out and reread. And there are particular of, so there's Larissa wrote a profile of the judge Richard Posner that I went to law school for my sins. And when I was in law school, I read this profile of Richard Posner. I would encourage people to look it up online. It has the best lead really of any article ever. It is incredible. And then there's novels, you know, a lot of which are kind of, I guess you'd sort of call them, they're sort of literary, but a little pulpy too. Like I always go back to A Secret History by Donna Tartt. That's one I take out from time to time and reread. I really loved Scott Giroux's first novel, Presumed Innocent. Incredible, incredible novel. That ability to kind of really paint a picture and create a world and bring these characters out, but in a way that also has, you know, a kind of muscular plot that gets you turning the pages. That's the stuff I love.
I love it. All right. What are you working on next? You mentioned New Orleans. I know there's a certain superstition about showing too much leg, but.
Yeah, that's all I can tell you. I'm working on a story in New Orleans, so keep an eye out for that. And I've got a book coming out in April, which is about a mysterious death in London. It's called London Falling.
There you go. London Falling. All right. Patrick Radden-Keefe, thank you so much for joining us on How to Fix It to talk about the troubles, our times, the state of journalism, and so much more.
It's great to be with you.